Hi, I'm Naomi. I'm 36. I was on the fence about pregnancy and all I heard was, don't you like children? And aren't you worried you're leaving it a bit late? Now I'm pregnant though, it's your career will never be the same, you know. Yeah, I do know, thanks. But despite deciding to baby, there's still so much more to find out from both camps. So here's a podcast on the Secret Recordings Network where I chat to baby wanters, baby rejectors and everything in between to see why we decide to baby or not to baby. In this episode, I chat to Julie about her experience as a disabled solo mum-to-be.
When you get pregnant, the hormones and also just being pregnant suppress your immune system. So that can do brilliant things to people with autoimmune conditions. So I went from using a wheelchair, my legs not really working, having no energy, feeling just awful, ill, to feeling great. I'm feeling the opposite to everybody else in their first trimester.
And I'm joined on this journey by my sister and best friend, Camilla.
Yo buseo.
We're still doing the different language hello game.
Which country? Yo buseo.
Which country are we offending this week?
Korea. And like literally everything you've been saying to me prior to me saying hello has just been not going into my brain because all I've been thinking is how to pronounce your buseo.
In my head, I thought it was going to be like some kind of African thing because it just made me think of Oti Mabusi from Strictly.
Oh, yeah. Oti Mabusio.
Oh, we've just dropped out of the Korean podcast charts. Thanks to that. That's good. So I had to have a little hospital trip, didn't I? Which was not very much fun.
No, it was not for anyone, but especially not you.
It happened after family quiz night and you weren't on the quiz that night. Absolutely ditched us, didn't you?
Sorry.
Family quiz is drying up a bit, let's face it. But anyway, yeah, basically I'd had abdominal cramps for about 6 hours that didn't go away, that felt a lot like period pains. And we rang the hospital and they said, oh, better safe than sorry, come in. So at 11 o'clock at night, I ended up at the hospital. And this is the hospital where I'll give birth. And I've never been there before because obviously I've just moved to Bristol. And I got there and it was like something out of a horror movie. So you entered the building in the reception and they were like, oh yeah, to get to the assessment unit, you just got to follow that corridor all the way down, keep going all the way, all the way, all the way, all the way. And when you reach the end, you're there. Only all of the lights were off. So I was expecting like maybe they've got those energy saver lights that when you walk along, they light up and make you feel like you're in the Michael Jackson music video. But no, that did not happen. Anyway, I got there. It was not a nice experience because Dan couldn't come in. You can hear everything that's going on in everybody else's cubicle. So I could tell you when the last time the woman next door went for a poo was 6 days ago. I can tell you the woman opposite how much blood she'd lost. Was it a teaspoon? Was it a tablespoon? No, it was an egg cup. And you just like, oh my god, this is intense. Yeah. And anyway,
I mean, it's not nice being in hospital at the best of times though, is it? God,
no, but I think it's so heightened when it's a baby because it's not you. It's like you're completely powerless. You can't do anything. Like, yeah. You know, if you've got something wrong with you, you go, oh, well, I can rest, or I can, if I've got a pain here, I'll take a painkiller or whatever it is. Whereas when it's the baby, you have no bloody clue what's going on. So in short, everything was fine. The nurses and the staff were lovely. Although the doctor, I did that thing and it's making me feel like a real old person. But you know, when you look at the doctor and you go, you look about 12.
Oh no. You sure you know what you're doing?
And anyway, she was lovely and everyone was lovely and everything was all fine in the end. And we got home at 2:30 in the morning and everything was okay. But I hope that don't happen again.
Do you know what I always think with the young doctors though?
Go.
They've literally just been trained, so it's fresh in their mind. Whereas some of the older doctors might have like, I mean, I hope they don't get bad habits a long way, but like they might.
Yeah, no, no.
So yeah, at least you know you were in like freshly educated hands.
True. And she slipped that speculum in like a daisy. So like a daisy?
Like an absolute pro.
That's not the same. first off, tell me who you are, a bit about you and your parental or non-parental situation.
So I'm Julie and I am a creative strategist, which is a job title, to be honest, it's a bit confusing, at Facebook and Instagram. And I work in the ads department. So essentially what I do is work as a consultant creative director, where I help brands and advertising agencies to make great ad campaigns for Facebook and Instagram, which is loads of fun because I was in the advertising industry for years and I was a creative director for years. And now I'm kind of on the tech side. It's a whole new world when you're not very techy. So that's what I do in my day job.
It sounds such a swish job, though.
I think it sounds fancier than it is by a country mile, yeah. But but I really enjoy it, actually. That said, you know, I do think it's a really good company. It's a great company also for women and for women who are going through fertility issues or any health stuff, actually, because I've been through all sorts. So yeah, I feel really lucky that I've been really supported through all that stuff and becoming disabled and all sorts of stuff, which I'll talk about. But the whole like parental situation or not, my status is that I am 33 weeks pregnant. 33 plus 3 is the way that you officially term it. So that's 33 weeks and 3 days. And I'm single, so I'm a single mother by choice, or a solo mum, as they tend to be termed. So kind of different to a single mum in that it's a decision that I made to have a baby on my own, and did it through IVF with a donor. And I've got two very cute dogs, one being a 10-week-old puppy, which is really good timing. Good timing for lockdown,
When I heard that you got a puppy, I did think, flipping heck, this woman really likes to throw herself in at the deep end in life.
Yeah, I know. Well, she's actually my fourth puppy that I've ever raised. And it's really easy once you know what you're doing. So it's not a problem at all. But everybody seems to be really worried that it would be a problem. And honestly, it's been so easy. She's a dream.
Are you hoping that raising a child is going to be as easy as raising a puppy?
Say, not in a million years, will it? Not in a million years.
Now, there are loads of questions that I want to ask you about pregnancy, because you are one of the first people that I've interviewed on this series whilst I'm pregnant and being able to speak to someone else while they are also pregnant.
I know, it's very exciting. How's it going? How are you feeling?
Generally, touch wood, I've been feeling pretty much like my normal self, but getting slightly freaked out at the expanding belly.
Oh, I love the belly. My belly, so my first trimester, my belly immediately, which was like bloating for sure from the IVF and stuff, but my belly immediately went massive. And I was on a work Christmas like conference do thing for a week where we were away in Dublin. And pretty much I just had to totally change my wardrobe and like wear just like massive baggy things for everything. I wasn't hiding it from everybody, to be fair, because a lot of people had known that I'd gone through IVF. But I also didn't want to just be like shouting from the rooftops. And I just had this huge like 6 month pregnant belly at like 3 weeks or 4 weeks or whatever it was. But the best bit for me about my first trimester is that it was the opposite to everybody else, in that I felt amazing. So it actually put me in remission from the disease that I have. Because I have Lyme disease, and that's from a tick bite that I got a few years ago. And what it tends to do is it really messes with your body, your tissues. So it's kind of messes up your glands and your organs and your joints and your nervous system. And in my case, my brain and a lot of my muscles and stuff, and your nerves and things like that. So it's quite problematic. But because what it does with your immune system is that it really damages that particularly, it can bring on autoimmune responses. So all like autoimmune conditions. And yeah, when you get pregnant, the hormones, and also just being pregnant, suppress your immune system. So that can do brilliant things to people with autoimmune conditions. So I went from using a wheelchair, my legs not really working, having no energy, feeling just awful, ill, to feeling great. I'm feeling the opposite to everybody else in the first trimester. Oh my God, so smug.
What a miracle.
I know, it's good, right? I mean, I don't have that now, don't get me wrong, but it was a joy. That first trimester was a bloody joy.
So it's only been a few years that you've had Lyme disease and therefore the disability symptoms that come with that.
Well, actually, I'm quite unlucky in that I was bitten a number of times. So I was bitten as a child, and then that did some damage to my immune system. But I kind of fought it off mostly. And my sisters were both bitten as well at the same time in the same park, and a friend of mine in the same park. And then I was bitten again in 2006 on a hiking holiday in Scotland in Perthshire in a real Lyme hotspot. And didn't know. I got the classic bullseye rash that about 50% of cases get. But I didn't realise that that's what it was, and the doctor didn't know. And I was really quite ill from that, but managed to kind of just about suppress the illness and carry on life as normal-ish. But I felt ill generally for a kind of since about 2006. And then got progressively worse. And then in about 2016, I went to Greece on a writing retreat and got bitten by a mosquito that carried a totally different type of bacteria or strain of Lyme disease, but still Lyme disease, that caused encephalitis. So my brain swelled up and I became fully paralysed temporarily, which was all quite scary, obviously. And then it started to do some serious brain damage and neurological stuff, which is super scary in hospital, to be honest. But what's worse is that actually the doctors didn't know anything about it, or they don't understand it here at all in the UK. Because also it was a specific Greek strain of Lyme that causes lots of neurological damage and blindness and stuff like that, which I didn't know. The doctors really just refused to believe that it was Lyme and were really... not very nice about it either. So when I was stuck in hospital and my brain had swelled up and I didn't know the Queen's name and I couldn't count backwards from 20 and I couldn't remember who was alive or dead in my family, like I was a real mess and I was on my own. But actually, ultimately, I just got kind of quite bad treatment from the doctors, who told me that it was stress. and I remember also when I said... I think one of the doctors said, "What do you do?" And I said, "Oh, I'm a creative director at Facebook." And they went, "Yeah, sure you are." and I was like, "What? I am, though." Yeah, that was a tricky time.
Blimey.
It was a tricky time.
Walking the dog around a cemetery to look for potential baby names, morbid or inspired. Near the new house, we've got a massive cemetery, and I've walked the dog here most days so that I can look at the gravestones and get a bit of inspiration. Edgar, Beryl, Reginald, Fanny. Fast forward a few years and you've gone, "Oh, I know what I'm going to do now. I'm going to have a baby."
Yeah, exactly. Well, the thing is, so when a lot of this was going on, before I had that last bite with the encephalitis and paralysis and stuff, I was married, and I was married to a really troubled chap, to be honest. And
yeah,
the reason, if I'm really honest, the reason I got married to him is just because I desperately wanted a baby. Because from the age of kind of 30, I immediately, like a switch flicked totally from my 30th birthday, and I was like, right, I desperately need a baby. And I met him at 32 and really married him so that I could have a baby, because he wanted to kind of get married before trying for kids. And then we tried together, actually, for about not that short, because we went and had Clomid, you know, the tablet that can help you to ovulate.
No.
But
I do now.
Yeah. So we tried for ages, but I wasn't really ovulating. And I wasn't ovulating, it turns out, because my body was saying, "Do not have a baby with this man." And so, thank goodness, body, you were a joy to me, because, yeah, it did me a favour by actually stopping my ovulation because of stress, actually, was the truth of being married to this individual that I was really scared of, actually, because he was really abusive. So I was quite terrified the whole time. And that fear, that fight or flight mode the whole time, stress stops you from ovulating, which is brilliant in this case. So yeah, we went to see a fertility doctor in the NHS, and they gave us Clomid, which is a tablet that essentially makes you like hyperovulate for just 1 month. And I looked at the tablets, and I looked at him, and I looked at the tablets, and these tablets can often create twin pregnancies, because obviously you like ovulate lots. And I was looking at them and I was thinking, well, that's twins, and that'd be brilliant because I've always wanted twins. And then I was looking at him and I was thinking, but that'd be triplets, because he's basically a child and a really problem child. So actually, those fertility tablets are the reason that I left him, because it was the prompt to make me realise that it was definitely not the right decision to stay with him and stay in that relationship. So then we split up and divorced, and which is a joy, and I couldn't be happier. And then I went into dating for ages to try and find someone else to panic have a baby with, which is, it's a seriously good look on dating apps, is this like stress.
I was just going to say, how do you pitch that? Is that in your biog? Is it on the date?
Oh, God. I mean, honestly, I was just really not appealing. I was trying very hard not to be the person that would raise it immediately, but the desperation was just like a stench, you know?
But you know what? Also, on a serious note, like I do think that I didn't meet my now husband until, so I was 32, nearly 33.
Yeah.
And I do think that when you're at a stage in your life where you know that you want something, and as a woman, you have that biological clock ticking away, so you know you haven't got all the time in the world, you kind of got to do those questions quite early.
You do, actually. And it's kind of a bit of a knobhead filter as well to have them even like or alluded to in your profile on dating apps.
Yeah.
But I think my thing is I had a double challenge because I was disabled at the time, so I couldn't really walk or stand very well because my legs are just basically super weak is the thing. And so going on dates and pretending that you're fully able-bodied and you're fine, so totally lying about that and kind of lying a little bit about the fact that you're only there to have a baby or, you know, because you want to find someone to have a baby with. Yeah, it just became this whole disingenuous mess where I had awful dates, to be honest, awful. And it was probably me just as much as them. And I would find somewhere to go on a date where I could park directly outside and then I could kind of like just stagger in. And then if I limped to go to the bathroom or something, I could just say, oh, I've got a bad back and things like that, just lies. Or standing at the bar, oh God, that's hard. So I always went places where I knew that there were stalls at the bar. And I would just always be able to prioritize finding a stall to, you know, or lean on stuff. And anyway, so that was all, you know, it was all quite ridiculous. My dating days, they were quite disastrous. And I just want to apologize, actually, like to all of the guys that I went on dates with. I was probably really mean as well, because I just don't think I was in the greatest headspace to be dating. So I would cut off early and just go home and just say, do you know what? It's not going to work. And just leave after like 15 minutes.
Yeah. Can I ask you a potentially slightly tricky or brutal question?
Of course.
When you were going on these dates with these guys, were you wanting to meet someone who you could make a life with and have a baby? Or were you wanting to meet them so that you could do the baby making thing and then if the other stuff happened, fine? Or
oh, I see. God, well, actually, no, I massively compartmentalized my needs. So one dating app was 100% about meeting the one and the baby father and the person that I was going to spend my life with, for sure. I wasn't interested in kind of getting knocked up by a stranger, to be honest, even though I considered it briefly. I have two sisters and one was on one moral side of the scale and the other sister was on the other side of the moral scale, and I was like in between the two. But then the other thing is that the illness had really played havoc with my hormones and I had a really high sex drive, so I was horny as anything the entire time. So I had a whole other app that I was using for just casual hookups and stuff, say sex kids, but you know, casual hookups and lots of fun, where I was also pretending to be able-bodied and not have a disability. So that was much more enjoyable, to be honest. That app and the casual hookups was way more successful and better than the let me find my next husband version. Yeah.
Why did you feel like you had to hide your disability?
Yeah, it's a funny one, actually. And I feel almost guilty about it a bit more now because I know more about ableism. But definitely at the time, I was really adjusting to even calling myself disabled, which there's no shame in being disabled. And all these euphemistic terms like differently abled and stuff are just embarrassing, frankly, because they just sort of almost shame the term disability, which is, there's nothing wrong with it. Being disabled is great. It's a point of pride, not of shame. Anyway, so I think I was really trying to adjust to it in my own mind, but mainly I just thought people wouldn't really be interested. They wouldn't like me. I did tend to bring it up with people, with casual hookup types more because they're just more open-minded people, is the truth. And I had much better reactions from anyone who was just into that world or into that kind of a relationship, I guess. It was less scary for them. And so I would definitely raise it the next morning with those people.
With that as well, in a way, when it is a more casual situation, you're expecting them to briefly come into your life and then leave. Yeah. Whereas if you're wanting to meet someone for the long haul, then you don't want to do those things that scare them off. And we all, like, yeah. God, everyone has the... I remember there's a Russell Brand sketch, which is brilliant, where he talks about having the all these like black eels within you that are the things that you want to hide from a potential partner. And then obviously further down the line of a relationship, of course, they all come flooding out.
Oh, God. And
because you can't hide it.
No, 100%. Yeah. And that's really true. I think it really is a bit of an idiot filter too. Had I put on my dating profile that I was disabled, I think, of course, you're not going to get people who fully understand what that means, but also you are not going to get people who are bigoted or who are going to be dickheads about it. You're only going to get really nice people. But what you also could get is people with fetishes for that sort of thing, and there are a lot of those.
Yeah.
And also I don't know how permanent it is. I still don't know how permanent it is, or you know, when my legs will go again or anything like that. So yeah, it was a bit of a self-protection perhaps at the time, I'm not sure.
Mad, isn't it, what it takes for your knobhead filter to kick in? I wish my knobhead filter had kicked in a lot earlier than it did in life.
I think I've always had... Well, no, actually, that's not true.
Were you about to say you've always had a knobhead filter?
Well,
do you want me to list all of your ex-boyfriends who I fucking hate? No. You know who you are.
No. I think I'm thinking more along the lines of internet dating, because actually a memory came up on my Facebook the other day where a guy had sent me a message on Tinder basically saying, like, are you up for a casual fling? And my immediate reply was, are you up for a white picket fence, a dog and children? And of course, he never replied.
So you then have gone on all these dates and you've gone, this is not working, this is not going to pan out, but I definitely know that I want to have kids.
Yeah.
How do you then approach that, knowing that you've got this incredible career, you also have this disability that affects your life in varying degrees,
yeah,
and to then go, I'm going to become a parent? Jesus, I had enough trouble deciding whether I wanted to become a parent without... that.
I know, but so you got there in the end.
I got there in the end, yeah. But how do you get to that stage?
Well, actually, that's probably the trickiest bit in a way, is when to give up dating, when to throw in the gauntlet. I think my middle sister was probably the major influence, because both of my sisters actually have got kids. Well, my elder sister's got two girls who are amazing, and my middle sister's got a brilliant boy. And she wasn't that long after having him where she was just kind of like, I just don't want you to miss out on this, basically. I think it would be a terrible tragedy if you missed out, because it's just a wonderful thing to be a parent. And that really did help me to kind of like make the final decision and not equivocate anymore around it. But then the stopping dating thing was really hard, because it's kind of a bit addictive for your ego as well. If you're feeling a bit like down and low, you just swipe on, you know, a dating app and get matches, and it makes you perk you up a little bit. So kind of deleting those apps, I don't think I did even until I was in the middle of the first trimester, I think. The final decision of stopping trying to look for someone and doing it on my own felt so empowering and amazing. I was so pleased when I finally made that decision. And also what I like was just blooming lucky, because I've got a good job and I was able to keep that down while being ill, because the company were really supportive. But also we have work insurance that actually helps with fertility treatment, which
wow,
is so
that's
rare.
Amazing.
I know, it's such a great company. And so I'm so lucky. I'm not just saying this, it's fully true, where, you know, I was able to get a fertility package from a clinic and then have that covered off by my work insurance. And it doesn't cover everything. I had to pay it out extra for some drugs and stuff. But still, it was an amazing help. And I'm bloody lucky, really. And also, it covers off the sperm donor thing, which is a fun subject in itself. Yeah. Anonymous donors.
Yeah, please tell me more about it.
Yeah, so choosing a sperm donor, for some people, is an agonizing thing. They go through pretty much every option globally because the sperm banks, obviously, in other countries that you can get sent over here. There are loads of Danish ones that are really popular, obviously, because people want lots of Vikings as their children. It's a bit weird. And then there's lots of, you know, obviously the American sperm banks have got huge numbers of people on them and stuff, so that's quite good. But then also what they don't have if you buy from overseas is they don't have regulation around it, so you don't necessarily know how many babies that particular donor had, and so you don't know how many half children your kid's gonna have. And so I think that can be quite a scary prospect. So I was quite determined to stay with the UK donors. But what happened is that not very long ago, there was a ruling put in place where the children and the father can contact each other at the age of 18 if they both consent. And that has actually just stopped a lot of donation. And so there are limited, really super limited numbers of donors in the UK these days. So I decided to essentially just go through my clinic and their sperm donor list of 8. So I narrowed my choices to essentially just who was there. But they're all really lovely.
It sounds like dating all over again.
Exactly. Yeah, kind of is, actually. And I sent the list, and you don't get to know a lot, but I sent the list to like lots of friends and family on WhatsApp and asked everybody what their favourite was. And everybody came back with exactly the same choice, which is the one that I went for. And all you get to know really is their ethnicity, their height, their skin colour, hair colour, occupation, education level, and then a little bit about them that they say about themselves, which in this case with this guy was that he said that he had a sense of humor, which I really liked, but I also thought, or are you just one of those people who think they're funny and they're not? So I was like, and he is essentially a ginger Irish teacher. He's pretty much all I know, who was 6 foot and likes metal and classical music and art and science. So, yeah.
Wow.
It's weird, isn't it? It's like dating. It's like a dating app.
It is weird because when you think about having your baby, do you wonder like, oh, I wonder if the baby will like classical music, and if it doesn't, is that nurture, or is that because it's somehow in the genes from this random sperm donor?
No, 100%. I mean, I think that it's almost certainly going to be a ginger baby for sure, because I'm blonde and I've got like a little inflection of warmth there. So I've got freckles and all that. So I think I'll probably have a super Irish looking baby. But yeah, with the other traits, I haven't thought about it much yet, but I think obviously as they're growing up, I would almost certainly think about it a bit. But what's really good actually about having gone through a really traumatic abusive relationship and then some lots and lots of health problems that were really quite affecting is that I tend to be a massive optimist these days about everything. And also I tend to be a massive underthinker. So I don't dwell on stuff at all. And it might
Can
be
you
to
give
do with
me
the,
some of that, please.
Well, I know, it's a joy. It might be something to do with brain damage, to be honest. So I wouldn't like wish brain damage on people so that they don't overthink.
True.
But I feel really, really lucky that I don't overthink things, because I've got so many friends who really do struggle with it. And it's a curse, isn't it? You know? So yeah, it's a joy that I'm an underthinker. It means that I make, you know, perhaps impulsive decisions like marrying idiots and stuff sometimes. Yeah, the rest of the time it means life's a lot easier.
As an overthinker, when I'm hearing you say that, I'm like, oh no, but then what if you, after you've had the baby and you've just got this new puppy and you've already got a dog, and you know, you don't know potentially after the pregnancy how it's going to affect your Lyme's disease and all the rest of it. Are you then going to go, oh shit, this was a really bad decision?
I think there's a possibility, but I don't tend to regret much in life. I don't actually really regret the marriage, to be honest. It's only the time that I wasted. So, or the, you know, prime fertility time that I wasted. But because I learned so many lessons and actually got so many good anecdotes out of it too. It's more that I think if I look back on it, I won't necessarily have any regrets, but I will probably just think, okay, well, I'll just kind of do it differently next time. Because I'm planning on having two. By the way, we'll see. I'm not really much of a planner, so I'm kind of just, you know, tentatively thinking about it.
That's classic underthinking right there. Yeah. This one's not even here and you're like, yeah, I'm on to the next one, but I'm admirable of that.
Optimism is a really useful all on that, I have to say, definitely. Foolish optimism, yeah. Often, like, it's not always a good thing, just to be clear. Like, optimism can be really ridiculous and inappropriate.
Yeah.
But yeah.
But it's also highly infectious, so I'm hoping that some of it is going to spread into me and I'm going to become an underthinker overnight.
Let's hope.
What, if any, fears do you have for post-baby arrival?
Yeah, actually, it's only really that I feel really awfully ill. If my legs don't work, it doesn't matter. You don't need your legs to be a good parent at all. I mean, apart from getting up and downstairs might be a bit trickier, but just slower, and that's okay. It's more just that if I'm feeling utterly, utterly awful, and Lyme disease does make you feel really awful, or if some of the co-infections of Lyme really kind of kick off and do funny things and I just can't function, that's what I'm a bit worried about. I think, though, that that's less likely now that I've got some brilliant doctors and I'm on brilliant treatment, and I'm still taking drugs now while I'm pregnant to prevent congenital transfer, because that's a risk. So I think mainly if I just feel horrific, and then definitely the other one is if I pass it on, because I do not want to be passing on Lyme disease to a child.
Yeah.
And that's why I'm taking all these drugs at the moment. That's why they will actually test the cord blood from the placenta to me and the umbilical cord. And then I send that off to a clinic in the US and they will test it for Lyme to check to see if the baby's got Lyme. And then they can do things quite quickly to try and like stop that spread in the baby as well. But that's quite a scary.
What are the chances of that happening?
I don't know, actually, because it's only been recently acknowledged that congenital Lyme exists. In fact, literally in the past few weeks, it's been like officially by the CDC, which is the Center for Disease Control globally, it's only been recently kind of like listed as a legitimate thing that happens. I mean, me and my doctors have known, and my sister, who the sister with Lyme disease, who's a scientist and is a bloody expert, she knows everything about Lyme. It's been incredibly helpful for me. She's my older sister. They have been saying for a long time and have known. She actually had Lyme disease and had two children whilst she had Lyme, but neither of the children, we think, have got Lyme. She was only able to test the second one, but we think neither of them do. So yeah. I don't know is the truth about actual. There's no data on like actual numbers of risks and stuff. But yeah, I'm an optimist that things will go well for me, whatever happens. However, by hook or by crook, she comes out, because it's a little she. My hairless friend from my dogs. However she comes out, she'll be an absolute joy and a gift, because I've wanted her for 10 years now, desperately.
Why am I not surprised that Julie has already decided and started planning having a second baby? The woman is bananas, but in the best way. I loved her.
Yeah, brilliant. Like, what an attitude to life.
Honestly.
I love that.
It blew me away. Like, I mean, I know that I am the total opposite end on the control freak spectrum, but I love that optimistic attitude of, oh, just go for it. Just do it. Yeah. Let's not think about the consequences.
We all need a pinch of Julie in our lives, I think.
Totally. Now, obviously, she was talking about second babies, and we had a message on Instagram, and I want to talk about this with you, Camilla, because M Baker, who I think listens to us in Australia, by the way. Don't try and say good day or something now. Oh, I knew she was going to do it. Sorry, Em.
I've been watching Love Island 2018. Oh, that was a bit rubbish, wasn't it?
Please stop. We don't want to lose any more listeners.
Okay, sorry, Em.
International listeners, we love you. Em says, I was a big fence sitter before getting pregnant, but the one thing that swayed me to baby was the option of just having one. There are loads of stereotypes about only children, but there are lots of benefits too. It's still taboo though, and people have told me that my kid will be a weirdo. How bad is that?
Oh, God.
I know. So she messaged to say that she was enjoying the podcast, but she was like, oh, maybe you should talk about second babies. So Camilla, as someone who has one baby, and I know who has been asked 70 billion times about if or when you're having another one, and sorry to be that person to ask the question for the 70 millionth on one time, but where are you at?
Well, it's weird because literally, and I think I've probably said this before, in the first few months after having Chester, I was like, no, one is enough.
Yeah.
And I'd always thought two before that. And all the way through Chester's 1.5 years nearly on this planet, I think I've like ummed and ahed both ways. But I do really want him to enjoy having a sibling to play with. And I think it's seeing friends with babies that have got siblings. It's still a tough one because I do wonder if that's me making the decision more for him than for myself. But then when I speak to anyone who's got two, they're like, you think you've not got enough love, but my God, the love just expands when you have that second one. So where am I at? Yes, I do want a second baby.
Yeah.
And not in the too distant future.
You've told me to not steal your baby stuff for too long, so.
Yeah, I'm basically going to wait until I can have the baby stuff back.
Honestly, Camilla saved me like £500 on like baby stuff. It's been the best thing in the world. But you're saying like, oh, you know, am I thinking that for him and not for you? But I think that's admirable that you would like want to have that for him. And it's not because, Jesus, you have a lot to sacrifice in the process of having a baby and being pregnant and parenting Jester whilst you're pregnant and all that stuff. So,
yeah. And also, I'm kind of relying on the fact that some of my friends have said to me as well, they play together so you can do things.
Yeah, I've heard that a lot.
I'm like, ooh, okay, yeah. That sounds good. I think like when I see him playing with his friends and stuff, I do just think, yeah, that would be so nice. And I think it was another podcast I was listening to. Ooh, not another podcast. Where someone said that having a second child and hearing them like laugh together is just the best thing ever.
Mum and Dad say that about us, don't they? That's why they like listening to this podcast.
Took you quite a while to like me though, didn't it? Really? Like, I'm imagining this like idyllic thing, but is Chester going to grit his teeth when he has a photo taken with the other child?
All the photos of us when we're kids, the early days, I hated you. But I love you now, so it's all fine.
Yeah, I think your love grew and grew, and that's okay, because now you love me so much.
It was a slow burn, but it was worth the wait, right?
I think sometimes they're the best relationships.
Follow my journey and tell us about your own on social media. We are at To Baby or Not. If you rate and review this podcast, not only will it massively help us out, please do, but it'll guarantee that your knobhead filter will be permanently on form.
Next time on To Baby or Not To Baby.
She's always wanted to be a mom, and it just so happens that she knew me, who wanted to be a surrogate. And before you know it, her and a partner have got me pregnant.